Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Teal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Most people who run for public office do so in the desire to serve their community or their state or their nation. And it seems that most people do indeed manage to hold on to that motivation, but we know that there are those who turn from public service to self-service. What is it that drives people to seek political power? And can you determine in advance, when you're there preparing to vote for someone, just what it is that motivates them? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Stanley Renshaw. He is a certified psychoanalyst. He is also a professor of political science at the City University of New York and developer and coordinator of the interdisciplinary program in the psychology of political behavior at the City University of New York Graduate School. Among other things, he is interested in political leadership and decision-making in the presidency, and he's done quite a lot of writing on the subject about character and the presidency. For example, one of his books is The Psychological Assessment of Presidential Candidates, and he's certainly written on that and other kinds of issues. And he's joining us this morning in this hour of Focus 580 to try to talk a little bit about all of these questions. The number, if you'd like to join in the conversation, and we certainly welcome people, welcome your thoughts and comments and questions. The number to join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good for anybody that would be making a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of our callers is that people just try to keep their comments, questions brief, just so we can keep moving along. But anybody's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Renshaw, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
I guess the reason that we started thinking about trying to have a conversation like this was that here in our state, this is something we've been thinking about and talking about for some time, as our governor, serious allegations of political misconduct have been made against our governor. He's been impeached by the House here. There will be a trial in the Senate. Seems very likely he will be removed from office and then would have to face other charges stemming from a federal investigation of his conduct in office. But having said all that, I'm sure that he is not the first elected official to try to turn his position to his advantage. Other people have done it, and I'm sure in the future other people will. I guess I wonder, I think about how it is I chose to frame the conversation, and I wonder, am I being naive in thinking, in fact, that most people who run for office are motivated by a desire to do public service?
Well, I think most people who run for public office do have that as a strong element of their motivation, but you know, it's not the only element in the motivation to seek office. And there's nothing actually wrong with having a number of motives for running for public office. Some people feel like they have something to contribute. It's a way of finding and exerting their voice in life. Some people do it on a policy basis. Some people do it because they like the feel of power and what comes with it. So usually running for office presents a mix of motivations. The one element you don't want in that mix, and we can talk a little bit more about the relative weight of the different elements in that mix, but one thing you don't want in that mix is the idea that you're in office and you're therefore entitled to treat it as if the rules don't apply to you, and that seems to be the case here.
Mm-hmm. There, you know, that, though, that's that seems it's interesting that you raise that point, because it does indeed seem that for people who have gotten into trouble, and I'm not just talking about, say, people who have been elected to office and have decided that that's a way that they can line their pockets. People who have been elected to office and been involved in various, you know, and sundry other kinds of misconduct, both large and small, one thing that does indeed seem to be common is that last point that you made, and that is that people get to a certain point and perhaps they do indeed to begin to feel that the rules that apply to everybody else don't apply to them. So it's natural to wonder, well, why that happens, and in fact, whether people like that thought that they were somehow special to begin with, and that they always thought that the rules didn't apply to them, or that that's something that happens to you if you are spend some time in a position where you have a great deal of influence. People come to you for favors. People want to do favors for you. And that after a while, you start to think, yeah, actually, I am different than everybody else, and the usual rules don't apply to me.
Well, I think you're right on both counts. The sense of entitlement is really an occupational hazard of political leadership. And you point out, and it's accurate to say that people can develop a sense that they are special, that they are entitled. They have people around them whose sole purpose is to do their bidding and carry out their will and so forth. And it takes a special kind of centeredness to keep your eye on the ball and your psychology in perspective. But having said that, it is also true that the sense of entitlement for most people has its origins not when they get into office, but well before that. And I'm thinking of a particular person. Can we talk about specifics, or is it...
I think, you know, unless you think we might get sued, I guess I would. I think it's probably okay to talk about specifics.
Okay, well, you know, I wrote a book about Bill Clinton.
Yes.
And the thing that started me out on this book was a question. I mean, everybody knew that Clinton was a person who, you know, was had fast recovery. He always recovered from the things that he got himself into trouble for. But as a psychologist, I was interested in the question of why did he always feel like he had to go over to the edge and dangle one foot over and maybe lurch a little bit more after that. And so in doing my research on him, what I found out was that because of his family circumstances, and most particularly his mother, he grew up very early on with two things that came to haunt him. One was that he was very talented. He's a very smart guy, and he was a person who drew people to him, and he was someone who stood apart very early. And so he had this sense of himself as somebody who was special. Now, usually when people develop that sense, and many people do in a family, it's the job of the parents to try to modulate that, to leaven it, so to speak, with some sense of perspective about the need to be careful with other people and so forth. But in Bill's case, he had a mother who was in some ways hedonistic and very absent, but also just reinforced the idea that he was somebody who was very special and the rules didn't apply, and she felt the same way about her own life. So as Bill grew up, he developed this sense of being special by virtue of his talents, which was very true, but he didn't also at the same time develop the sense that that has to be modulated to some degree by a sense of responsibility or ethics, if you will. And, you know, he got himself into trouble in the White House primarily because he couldn't contain his impulses and actually felt as if he didn't have to. And so that kind of history is not one that's, that you don't see often. As I said, it's an occupational hazard. And so when you get the combination of the early experiences plus the occupational hazard of being in an office where everybody is, you know, saying, well, you know, Mr. Governor, Mr. President, you know, that's terrific, you're wonderful, that's the greatest insight I've ever heard, yes, sir. It takes a special kind of grounding to keep your perspective and not go off the path. And that's a real challenge for many people.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say it's actually a challenge for many people in regular life, and I would say it's an especially large challenge for people in public life and leadership positions.
Yeah. Just very quickly, I'd like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned. We're talking with Stanley Renshaw. He's professor of political science at the City University of New York. He's developer coordinator of the interdisciplinary program in the psychology of political behavior at City University of New York Graduate School. He is also a certified psychoanalyst. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just again, talking about what it is that motivates people to seek office. I guess that we might like the idea that someone would be motivated by public service, and that what they would do is that they would say to the community, what I want to do here is what's best for the community, and then to, in a sense, open it up and say to the community, all right, what do you want me to do? It seems much more likely that people would say, yes, I want to do what's best for the community, but they already have an agenda. They know, or at least they think they know, what indeed is best for the community. I mean, is it really realistic to expect that one of the reasons that people run for office is that indeed they have an agenda, they have some ideas about what's best for the community, and they want to be able to implement them. So they're not going with a blank slate. The very motivation to run is the feeling that I know what really we need to do, and darn it, I'm going to go and do that.
Well, most people who aspire for positions of leadership have a sense of the purposes to which they want to put it, and it's probably a good thing that they've thought about it for a bit of time and developed their ideas. On the other hand, the idea that there's a unified community doesn't quite fit politics, and certainly not democratic politics, and most certainly not American politics. There are many voices in the community, and not everybody is singing the same tune. So when you say that a person would, you know, put their ideas out to the community or ask what the community wants, you're liable and likely to get a variety of views about what you need to do. So, you know, it's a crossover. You don't want a leader who can't respond to the public desire, but on the other hand, you definitely don't want a leader who simply goes in the next direction that the next person they speak to suggests.
All right. Well, we have some folks here to to talk with, to bring into the conversation, see what's on their mind. 333-9455, by the way, here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. And I have two comments and then one question. I have read some time ago Friedrich Engels' piece about the origin of the family, private property, and the state, which compelled me to think both in political terms and in the patrimony. And as that evolved and into the written word and politics in general, and now we have this morass of contradictions that we live in now. My other question is, have you ever read or heard of, and I ask this question quite regularly, of Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who was a student of Freud?
I have heard of Dr. Reich, but I didn't hear the first question. I heard a comment. I wasn't sure it was a question.
Yes, well, then I failed to put the proper emphasis on it. But what do you think of what Friedrich Engels had to say in regards to the evolution of patrimony? And the last thing, just a comment about I saw this or heard it on 580 or some other PBS program, and Bill Clinton asked why he did what he did there in the Oval Office, and his answer was, because I could, which I think is, in general, the thinking of politicians in any venue, and that has been my experience. I've been around that stuff some. So those are my questions. I'll ring off and give somebody else time.
Okay, you can respond to that any way you like.
Well, I'm still not sure about the Marx Engels question, so I'll pass that by, not understanding it too well. But the idea that I do it because I can is part of the sense of entitlement that people have. But you know, not every political leader is like that, and a great many are circumscribed by first the sense of conscience, and secondly, the sense or the potential for shame. The difference between the two is briefly this, that conscience is your internal sort of right-wrong meter or mechanism, and it goes on entirely within yourself, whereas shame is exposing a transgression to a larger community. And so it's a two-step barrier, if you will, to let's call it bad behavior. And if usually most of us know that doing something that's wrong is wrong, and you know we stop ourselves from doing it, even if we might have the impulse to do it. But the added issue here for public leadership is that if you get caught in a transgression, and then you are exposed, it's not a matter of conscience at that point. It's a matter of having transgressed and having been seen to transgress in a public arena. Most people feel an acute sense of an embarrassment. It's something they try to avoid. That's why shaming is a powerful tool on some occasions. And so what's curious, and your governor actually, to get back a little bit to him, is curious in this way too, in so far as he clearly doesn't know the difference between right or wrong, or chooses not to act on that distinction. But what's more astounding is that he seems to have no sense of shame. And that's a dangerous combination for a high-level public official.
I wonder, do you think that it might be the case that some of the aspects of an individual's personality that might make him or her appealing as a candidate and that might make a voter likely to choose that person then actually would work against them would work against them doing a good job once they got into office? I mean, is what we're looking for in a candidate, and then we're actually looking for in an elected official, are they different, or are they the same thing?
Do you have a specific idea in mind? I have a general response to you.
Well, maybe I don't. I admit it's kind of a vague question. Go ahead and give whatever response comes to mind.
Well, I think it's true that there's a discrepancy between the kinds of things we vote for and the kinds of things we know about a candidate. Believe me, there's nobody who's more invested in presenting him or herself as they prefer to be seen as a candidate for high office. I mean, that's the whole function of their candidacy, is to present themselves in the best possible light. You want somebody who knows what they're doing, they'll, you know, cram and be able to tell you who the president of this country or that country is. You want somebody who's got a vision, they'll, you know, go back to their advisors and grab themselves a vision. I'm not saying that any of these things are necessarily phony or fake, but I am saying that depending on candidates themselves to present you with an even-handed account of their strengths and weaknesses, which everybody has, is a lost cause. They're simply not going to do it. They're in the business of gaining power and getting elected. So the question then becomes, what do you do to find out the information that you need to know? And the answer to that is that first you need to know what it is that's important about political leadership. And that's a question we don't ask very often. We ask, you know, is the person, you know, got a winning way? Are they verbal? Can they relate to people in an audience? All of those things are nice things to have, but they don't really involve the essence of leadership. I'm reminded. I think, you know, we like intelligent candidates. You know, we have, you know, the Bill Clintons and Barack Obamas. They're, you know, clearly far and away very, very smart people. But I remember an interview on Nightline that Ted Koppel had with Bill Clinton, and he asked Clinton a question. And Clinton, as you may recall, was, you know, he could go on for many, many words in a sentence. And so, you know, he went on for 2 or 3 minutes, and Koppel said at the end of this, you know, the more you speak, the less I feel I understood about the answer to my question. And so the point is that eloquence and intelligence are nice to have, but we really need to know how people assess the options in front of them, how they weigh the elements, the kinds of judgments they bring to bear, the perspectives they have to offer, the ability to not get blown off track. If I may, again, you know, I wrote another book on George W. Bush, and there was certainly a lot to criticize him for, but one of the things that was very clear about this guy is that he was able to have the courage of his convictions. And you may disagree with those convictions or not disagree with them, as the case may be, but he wasn't blown off course by this development or that development, but kept his eye pretty much on what he thought was an important set of goals to achieve. And that is, you know, a rarity in public life, not to be blown off course by the winds of, well, let's call them criticism or suggestions or whatever else may come your way. And we don't get a chance to really see that in operation during campaigns very often. If I may, I have two mm-hmm. examples that, mm-hmm. that come to mind. One is the so-called sister soldier moments. Do you know what that phrase refers to?
Yes, I do seem to recall that. She was a rap artist, and she said something controversial and problematic, and she was associated with a particular candidate, and there was a lot of dithering on the candidate's part about whether he either wanted to embrace her or wanted to say, I don't want to have anything to do with her.
Right. Well, it was Bill Clinton and this lady made a record in which she advocated the killing of policemen.
Right. Yes. Now it's starting to. It's been a while. It's starting to come back to me now.
Yes. Well, that's historical memory. When you do this stuff, you know, all the time, this stuff is fresh in your mind for some reason. It's anyway. It's that wasn't the right thing to do. And, you know, people were just amazed. Oh, my God, it's an amazing thing. He said, you know, you shouldn't have a song which says that killing policemen is a good thing to do. And this was touted, of course, by the Clinton people as an example of his ability to stand up for things, his courage. You know, it struck me at the time, and still in retrospect does, that it's, you know, a pretty, I don't know, measly courage if all you can do is say, well, you shouldn't go say that you ought to go around shooting policemen. It seems a minimalist qualification. And so we saw it again with Barack Obama and having Rick Warren give a prayer at the inaugural events. And this was hailed as a, you know, a gigantic indication of, you know, his courage and his strength in some quarters. And, you know, Rick Warren is a guy who's got, you know, points of view that are, you know, well within the mainstream of American political thought. And inviting him may be a signal of some sort, but it's no testament, no profile in courage. And besides, you had Mr. Lowry, the other invitee, to balance that off. And so, we we don't know often what we need to ask, and we're not given much help from the campaigns in finding it out.
Yeah. Just for a second, and I have a number of callers here, so I want to get to. I guess I just want to go back to some of your comments about the former president, Mr. Bush, that is Bush 43, the man who just left office. That some people indeed have said, as you said, that one of the things perhaps they would admire about him was that he had his principles and he stuck to them. And I think that we want our political leadership to have principles. And at the same time, though, people said that, you know, well, it's also, I think we'd also like to have someone who every once in a while asks himself, now, could I be right about this? Could I possibly be wrong? Should I think about, you know, check what it is I believe and try to examine that and at least raise the question with myself that I could be wrong, that maybe I'm going in the wrong direction and simply, you know, standing by my convictions because they are my convictions may not necessarily be the best thing. Now, I'm practicing without a license here, so
okay.
I guess I'm wondering what you think about that and about trying to have some sort of balance between the idea that one has principles and you stand by them, and have that balanced at least in part by the idea that, well, you know, it is possible that one could be wrong about what you think, and therefore the policies that you've staked out maybe are not the best ones.
Right. Well, I think you see that pretty much with the war in Iraq. But I would take your point. I think it's well taken that you need somebody who's able to revisit what you're doing. And I actually don't know the extent to which Bush did or did not do that. I've heard reports on both sides of that issue, and I said to my wife some time ago that when the Bush Library opens, it's one of the few libraries I'd like to visit to take a look at the National Security Council minutes for much of the debates on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do need both. You know, the question is how to balance those. And so that's where you would have to wind up. Yeah. You know, Bush was a guy who came to one large conclusion rather early on in his presidency, which was that America had been attacked and that America was at war. And at least as far as I'm concerned, that was a signal insight. There are lots of other ways that it could have been understood, and he went straight ahead from that basic understanding. Once you reach a rock-bottom understanding of a basic principle like that, then the direction that you take, at least in his mind, was pretty clear, and there may be ups and downs. So when you say, you know, question what you were doing, you know, my sense is that Bush did question, and he certainly questioned what was going on in 2002, 2003, and especially into 2004 in Iraq. But once you're on the road, then what do? Do you pull out? Do you partition Iraq? Do you keep pulling ahead to try to find a solution so that you can have a viable pro-Western democracy in the heart of that region? Those are complicated questions, and they flow from the original sort of bridging decision. The bridging decision was first that America was at war, and secondly that Saddam had to be removed. Now, I know the arguments on both sides of the Saddam question. He could have been contained. He could not have been contained. I know those pretty well. But once you've reached the rock bottom conclusion that he couldn't be contained, that the sanctions were weakening, that he would get out from under them, and that he was a dangerous character who couldn't be left in power, and you have to remove him, then it seems to me that you have to follow through, and any policy is going to have its ups and downs, and certainly Iraq had many more downs than at least I personally think were necessary. But you have to understand from the perspective of the person making the decision what that means. And so I think that Bush searched around in 2004 and 2005. He didn't have a counterinsurgency plan that would work. There wasn't any doctrine in the government for counterinsurgency. He also didn't have generals that he could rely on very well. Sanchez, for example, comes to mind. So until he had both a policy and the people to put it in and enough troops to make the policy work, there wasn't any viable option available to him. And so, you know, I see him as sort of muddling through until he got to a place where he could do something to fix the prognosis, so to speak. So, you know, I'm then back to the original question that you asked, which is, isn't it better for somebody to, you know, take a look at what they're doing? And the answer, of course, is yes, but there are some circumstances where the situation requires you to go on and not pull up stakes and back away.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are a bit past our midpoint here, and I have some other callers I want to get to, but I just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Stanley Renshaw. He's professor of political science at the City University of New York. He's also developer coordinator of the interdisciplinary program in the psychology of political behavior at City University of New York Graduate School. He is also a certified psychoanalyst. We're talking about the psychology of political leadership, trying to talk a little bit about what motivates people to run and serve, and how it is they conduct themselves. And one of the questions we raised at the beginning was, well, why is it that sometimes people turn from public service to self-service? A dense and complicated subject area here, but we're certainly open to questions and comments from callers. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have several here lined up. We'll start with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
I originally had my thoughts all organized, but that was about 20 minutes ago. Let's see if I can be coherent. It seems to me that one of the reasons that some people go into public service is because of family expectations, family one-upsmanship. I think we can see that with Al Gore, with the Kennedys, with the Bushes, definitely. You can probably come up with some other people. I'm also intrigued and interested in the possibility that some people may start out in their lives with getting away with things, with being able to lie and people believing them and thinking that's okay and being used to that and developing an arrogance. And it particularly interests me when you couple that with superficial or surface religiosity. I don't think that there's all that much difference between our governor. I don't know what his religious... He doesn't seem to espouse a religious connection as one of his ways of hiding what he does. But Sarah Palin, for instance, governed from Wasilla and charged the government a per diem rate for expenses that she would have supposedly incurred for hotel and travel to Juneau, the state capital, when she didn't actually travel. It was something like 300 and some odd days she did this for. And yet she was notorious for staying at home and not coming to do the business of government in the state capital, which is even worse than our governor. And yet she claimed that she was a reformer. I didn't know about this until I heard a program on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and she was interviewing a columnist for the Anchorage newspaper, and he had been following her career in Alaska for a long time. And he debunked some of the stories about her, but then I hadn't heard this one, and I thought, well, this guy should know. Watching Bush, you know, he can stand up there and say something, and I look at him, and I look at how he's delivering it, and I think, you're lying to me, buddy. You're looking around to see, are they going to believe me? I can just see it in his face. One of the prime examples is a lie he tells over and over and over again. They attacked us because they hate us because we're a democracy. People aren't going to give up their lives because we're a democracy. They're not going to be suicide attackers because we're a democracy and they hate us. There has to be some other reason. Give me a break, buddy. That, and that's just one of them. And it just, the arrogance is how I would describe the Bush presidency and the willingness to lie. Some things I think he probably believed, and apparently he believed Cheney. Maybe you could talk about this willingness, this ability for some people to lie. I've also, one of the other reasons I'm mentioning it is that I'm a landlady, and we had a house on campus, and I had one tenant who would look me in the eye and lie to me. And at first I believed him, and then I caught him in several lies. And I began to realize that he could just lie with a perfectly charming exterior. He was much better at lying than Bush. And then I just refused to believe him and would call him on things. But I had more power than I do with Bush. Comments?
Well, there's a lot there. You can press a wrench on. You'd take on any of that you like.
Well, my memory doesn't fail, I think there were sort of three observations. The first one was about family life, and I think the three people the lady named are very true, the Gores and the Kennedys and the Bushes. I'm not sure it's one-upsmanship on the part of family members. JFK was sort of recruited by his father when his brother Joe, who was considered the real rising star, was killed, and he was an ambivalent politician for much of his life, including some of the time that he spent in the presidency. The family dynamic is really interesting. Gore was selected out by his parents and literally trained, his father was a senator, to become president, and the pressure on him was very strong to enter into that career. Bush took a different path. He started out, of course, in business, and came to politics after some years pursuing a business career. And the thing that interested me about Bush there was that once he set his sight on public office, he ran first for Congress and so forth, and then didn't make it and became ran for governor after he had gotten involved with the Texas Rangers. Was that it takes a particular kind of psychology to enter into a field that your father or mother, I guess, as well, has reached the highest levels of. You know, you're competing against somebody who became president. And so it takes some courage to say to yourself, you know, I'm going to set out on this path and see what happens. Most people who come from families where, you know, parents have reached very high levels of positions opt to distinguish themselves in other areas, primarily because of the competitive factor and the comparison factor. And, of course, for many years, Bush, George W., was confused with his father. There were even campaign commercials in which he was confused. So that's apropos the first point. It's well taken. The second point, I don't think Sarah Palin has any comparison whatsoever to your governor. I've seen the debates. I haven't followed them very closely about per diem expenses and whether she could or shouldn't and whether this was a matter of public record. All of these things are things that people know and can find out about, and so there's a certain premium in making sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's. If you're taking per diem expenses and you have to submit a voucher to the government, and that's public information, it would be sort of silly and self-defeating, to say the least, to charge things that you weren't doing and so forth and so on. It seems to me that whatever you think about whether she ought to be living at home and governing from there or how much time she spends in the official residence, they're buying and selling offices is really quite a step level up from that kind of debate. And so I wouldn't agree that, you know, they're the same thing or even in the same ballpark and probably even on the same planet. With regard to Mr. Bush, well, you know, I've had the same experience the lady caller has had about people looking at me and talking with me and lying to me directly. And I don't believe that you can look at a person and tell when they're lying. There's a whole sort of subscience about facial expressions and eye tics and muscle movements and what they reveal or what they don't reveal. But it's very hard to tell what people are, the degree of truthfulness that people have by simply looking at their face. And she may feel she can look at Bush and know that he's lying. I can't rely on that kind of observation for the kind of work that I do. But I would say about governments in general, and Bush in particular, and Obama as well, that any time a president says anything, there are hordes of people who are immediately checking out the extent to which it's true, whether it's been true in the past, whether the context is right, whether the implications are correct. In other words, there are a lot of checks and balances in the sphere of political discussion. And, you know, people, Bush thought, and he firmly believed, that we were attacked because the people who did so, the higher levels, not the muscle people who, you know, took the planes, but people wanted to strike out against the United States for its policies and for its perspectives. The people who would like to impose their kind of rule in Afghanistan or elsewhere are not people who are Democrats. They don't like democratic values. They don't like elections. They tried to hijack or stall those elections in Iraq, and if they had the chance, would do it again. So there's some element of accuracy in that. That's that's what Bush believes. You know, is that a lie? If I believe something to be the case, I'm not sure I would qualify it as a lie. A lie to me is something you know to be absolutely false and go ahead and say it as if it were true. And I don't think that's an accurate representation of at least that particular thing.
Well, we only have about 7-8 minutes left. We have several other callers. I hope the caller will forgive me for going on and trying to get at least one other caller in. And we'll go next to, we have a couple of Champagne people. We'll go next to line number 2. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Finally. yeah, there are many paths and roads on the way to ruin and corruption, and there are both general questions and particular questions. I mean, you brought up the issue of Clinton's mother. I think you could tell an awful lot about Bush by looking at his mother, and, you know, explains a lot of his behavior. But to a more general question, while I haven't run for office myself, I have been on the inside of some electoral campaigns as well as grassroots organizing. And so much of campaigning is about developing relationships and as well as, you know, being in political office. And there's also the issue of when you're in a campaign process, there's a lot of pressure. And people have to make decisions sometimes very quickly, and you're also, you know, doing that in relationship with people who you've developed relationships with. Some you know better than others, and sometimes you've known people for a long time, and you know, things develop incrementally for some people. I think there are probably a lot of people who were, you know, very good intentioned. But as time goes on and, you know, a decision is made here, a request is made there, and it may seem innocuous at the time and, you know, then later less so. And, you know, these things, they just build up over a long period of time and develop a kind of psychology as well. And I wonder if you could look at that somewhat.
Well, I think that's a very accurate observation. I think things happen by degrees for most people. I don't know if you've ever heard of, there are very famous experiments in social science. They're called the Milgram experiments, and essentially they consist of having people come into a room and give electric shocks to people if they don't know or can't remember words that they're supposed to memorize. And one of the things that they found out in that experiment is that once people, you know, once you give the first shock, the second shock is easier to give. And once you give the second shock, the third one's easier to give. And once you get to the fourth or fifth level of shock, there's really no place to stop you. And life, of course, you're absolutely right, is very much like that. There are things, proposals that are made, and nobody stops the action and comes in and tilts a red light and says, whoa, wait a second, you have to think about this because down the road. And what we know about people is that it's very rare for people to think through the implications of what they're doing now. It takes a special kind of person, and especially when the things are subtle, as you say. So, yes, I would say your point is extremely well taken, and many people have that problem. But you see, I would only add to that that that's the process of becoming encumbered, so to speak. And there's a psychology that's outside of that process, which is the person's individual psychology. Some people like to draw, you know, strong lines. They have a strong sense of what's right or wrong, and you know, you might agree or not agree with their particular lines, but it's easier for them to know where they stand and what to do about this particular problem or that. Other people are a lot looser. You know, they go all the way from, well, you know, sure, whatever, or, you know, they may even go up to, like your governor, anything goes. And so that's a whole different range of an individual psychology and stance towards those kinds of issues.
All right, we'll try to go at least one more caller, and that would be another Champagne person, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about our current president. I agree with you that Bill Clinton, brilliant as he is and charismatic as he is, may have had some arrogance and the expectation that he didn't have to worry about ordinary rules. And that may have been related to his growing up patterns. But I wonder what your comment is about our current president, who I've never read his books, so I can't comment on those. But it seems to me that growing up half black, half white must take a different toll on the psyche than growing up in a white family where you're kind of held up to be the shining star for the family. And so I wonder, A, have you read his books? And two, do you think, now our current president is certainly as brilliant, if not more so, than Clinton. So, and he is very charismatic. We've seen that all over the world. So I'd like to hear your feelings about him.
Well, he's a terrifically interesting man to somebody with my interests. And I was talking to your producer before, and I'm actually in the beginnings of a research project on him. And I'll eventually write a book on him. And the question that, you know, it always starts out with a question with Bill Clinton. It's why he always felt like he had to go over the edge. With Barack Obama, it's the question of who is he and what does he stand for? And you talk, I have read his books, and you talk about his experience as someone raised in a mixed family. But, of course, he wasn't actually so much raised in a mixed family. He was raised in a white family. His father had taken off to go back to Kenya to try to build a career there in high government service. And his mother actually spent a number of years doing field work in Indonesia for her dissertation at the University of Hawaii. So he was a guy who not only had an absent father, but in some respects for his adolescent years, an absent mother. And so that's a particular dynamic that's very interesting. And you know, you ask yourself, or at least I ask myself, how does that work that a guy who is struggling with large identity issues. You know, is he white? Is he black? What kind of black is he? How does he fit into the civil rights movement that's going on? Is he really in it or removed from it, and so forth? He's trying to wrestle with those questions. And I think that's a major element of his psychology up to and including, I would say now. My own view is, at least at this stage of my work, I don't think he's, you know, fully resolved those questions yet. And, you know, Reverend Wright is my key example of how he hasn't resolved them. But at any rate, it's an interesting set of questions. So you ask, what is it like for a person to come to their own sense of themselves primarily on their own? And you get the sense of a person who is, Barack is very reserved. He's, you know, certainly able to make very close relationships. There's no issue, it seems, there. But there is a reserve, and there is a part of him that is removed, and there's a certain opaqueness, both to his points of view and to his, I would say, let's call them his convictions, and what the level of his courage is with regard to his convictions. I listened to the whole campaign. I spent a lot of time with it. Of course, change we can believe in, but it's unclear exactly how that change will work out. If it means simply being different than Bush, well, you know, you can do some easy things by saying things in a nicer way, but some of the policies that Barack Obama seems to be putting into place, and some of the people he's putting into place, are, in a sense, the continuation of Bush doctrine policies. And so it's just, you know, unclear, and I don't expect personally to have figured this out yet, and I don't think I'll be able to do that if I ever do it without spending a lot more time and seeing more of what he does. Mm. But he's a complicated guy, and I think, you know, we all hope he does terrifically well. You know, I hope he's as successful as everyone else hopes that he'll be.
Pardon me for interrupting you. We're going to have to stop there because okay. I'm here at the end of the time. Our guest, Stanley Renshaw, is professor of political science at City University of New York. He is also a certified psychoanalyst, written a lot of books on political psychology. I'll just mention two: High Hopes, The Clinton Presidency and the Policy the Politics of Ambition, if you'd want to read about Mr. Clinton, and then also In His Father's Shadow, George W. Bush and the Politics of Transformation. You can look for them at the bookstore or the library. Professor Renshaw, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.